it's a pleasure to be invited to give a paper. I always like to apologise before I begin the paper, because this is work that I sort of parked in 2013. So I feel like it's an old friend. I'm just going to dive straight in. So today I'm going to talk about my work, or past work, on the historical development of a distinct set of human dog practices. The use of bloodhounds to follow scent trails in police investigation. The project explores, or what I intended to explore, what might be termed the history of canine forensics by focusing on one iconic breed associated with such practices, the English bloodhound, in American and British policing over the course of the last 150 years. This transatlantic project involves two interrelated strands. First, the history of a hunting form of knowledge and practice, which in Carlo Ginzburg's classic analysis of a clue-centered evidentiary paradigm binds the human animal closely to other species. Second, how the practical application of the species collaboration opened up new possibilities for forensic investigation and inquiry, and also resonated in wider public spheres, channeling, expanding, and reconfiguring pre-existing cultural codes, conventions, and scripts for the act and performance of smelling and human-dog and relationships. There are two significant. See if this works.
Point it at the laptop.
Oh, the laptop. Oh. Yeah, okay. There are two significant turning points which provide my chronological frame. First, the practice of using bloodhounds to track criminals was first established by elite pedigree dog breeders in late 19th century Britain, but gathered momentum in America in the early decades of the 20th century, leading to the admissibility of scent evidence in US courtrooms. The practice of man training commences with the dog's identification of an individual's base scent, derived from an article of clothing as a scent guide. The dog then follows the scent trail to the exclusion of thousands of unique scents along the same path, including human animal and non-human animal ones. The second turning point, the second turning point was the attempt of a group of American bloodhound handlers in the last quarter of the 20th century and into the 21st century to professionalise and standardise these working practices. And in more recent decades, there have been attempts to extend the role of the breed in forensic investigations beyond the practice of trailing. Oh, I'm not going to get the hang of that. Central to this new enterprise is the practice of what is known as scent lineups, in which dogs link human scents collected at the crime scene, hoovered up in fact, and then stored in labs, to samples from suspects, also gathered up and bottled, and then stored in the lab and analysed by a laboratory technician. And this practice is most associated with and has gained particular notoriety in Texas. Might not be a surprise there. Okay. So although this project observes chronological boundaries, it does not necessarily proceed in linear fashion. My intention has always been to focus on a series of exemplary murder cases, using them as apertures through which discrete historically situated instances of canine scent work can be discerned, in which a range of constituencies were forced to take sides and to assert their presence in the emergent discourse of canine forensics. In the process of such events shaped expert and public understandings of legitimate and illegitimate forms of forensic knowledge and practice, catalysing cultural and social contests about the nature of human-animal boundaries and relationships and the social and cultural meanings of scent in modern culture. Now I want to turn to one of my exemplary cases, the proposed use of bloodhounds to hunt, the proposed use of bloodhounds in one of the most notorious police investigations of the modern period, the hunt for Jack the Ripper in London 1888. At the centre of the so-called Autumn of Terror is Whitechapel, a notorious locality, associated with depravity and deprivation in the Victorian imagination. Whitechapel was situated at the western edge of the East End, home to London's vast working class, existing cheek by jowl with the more important financial and respectable districts of the West End. For Victorians, Whitechapel was understood to be a bounded sensorial space, characterised by slum stench and filth, and a labyrinth of both pleasure and danger, cloaked by darkness, confusion, environmental degradation, and visual disguises, calamity and disorder. The police appropriation of bloodhound training in the Ripper case endeavoured to introduce a new perceptual threshold, extending human detective abilities in the hunt for the murderer. Focusing in detail on the controversies surrounding the deployment of bloodhounds in the East End enables us to consider canine forensics as an emergent and contested forensic tool, and the challenges it confronted in its attempts to translate scent into a valuable forensic object. Can I have a glass of water, please? My mouth's drying up. Just as I was getting momentum. Okay, so to the story. On the 9th of October, London billboards carried the headline, Sir Charles Warren hunted by bloodhounds. The career of Sir Charles, Chief Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, appeared to be engulfed in crisis. In the first week of October, following the murders of Elizabeth Stride and Catherine Eddowes, the Ripper's third and fourth victims, the publicity surrounding the Whitechapel murders reached new heights. At the inquest into the victims' deaths, concerned members of the public demanded that, in the event of another murder, the police should unleash manhunting bloodhounds on the streets of Whitechapel. The commissioner caved in into public pressure and made contact with well-known bloodhound breeders in the country. In the following weeks, Sir Charles held practical experiments in London, West London Park, to test and display the bloodhound's manhunting skills, recruiting two pedigree hounds named Barnaby and Burgo, and their handler, Edwin Brough. Brough arrived in London with his prize hounds on the 6th of October. On the following morning, the demonstration of his hounds' olfactory abilities began in a deserted Regent's Park and repeated later that day in Hyde Park. In both of these trials, Barnaby and Burgo successfully hunted strangers, even though the trials were deliberately crossed several times in an attempt to deceive them. Within 2 days of the trials, Sir Charles issued instructions that if the Ripper were to strike again, the body of the victim must not be touched until the dogs had been put on the scent. It was just over 4 weeks later that the Ripper struck again, brutally killing Mary Kelly on the 9th of November. At first, the press reported that the bloodhounds had been put on the scent as soon as her dismembered body had been discovered. But it soon emerged that Sir Charles had resigned the night before Kelly's body had been found, and in his absence, no one knew where the animals were, or how, or where they could be found. Now, in conventional narratives of the 1888 Whitechapel murders, the story of Sir Charles, Brough and the bloodhounds is concluded merely as a bizarre sideshow offering further proof of a horribly botched police investigation. But I want to suggest that although the dogs might not have been put on the actual track of the Ripper in the East End, from the time of the public experiment in Regent's Park on the 9th of October until the next and what would be the final murder on the 9th of November, dog fanciers, breeders, handlers, commentators, seasoned hunters joined an expansive discussion concerning the relative merits of unleashing bloodhounds onto the streets of Whitechapel. So rather than being some non-event, the occasion provides a platform for analysing the contingencies shaping the various cultural, practical and material challenges in securing dogs as reliable hunters of human scent in a high-profile murder investigation. So to use a Holmesian analogy, the failure to use the dogs against the Ripper constituted a particularly curious incident involving dogs that didn't bark in the night time. Tales of charismatic animals and eminent dog breeders at work in London's parks and potentially on Whitechapel's thoroughfares appeared in the press coverage of the Ripper murders. And these paid homage to the bloodhound as a historic and noble animal. So by the time of the Ripper murders, through pedigree breeding practices, companionship and training, the English bloodhound had acquired a distinct identity as an efficient, civilised and gifted man-tracker. Training bloodhounds to hunt human scent had first developed as an elite sport, an aristocratic form of leisure emerging out of the social landscape of pedigree dog breeding and showing. A socially privileged and elite world that became established in the second half of the 19th century, establishing many of the dog breeds and ways of related dogs that we see today. And within this world, late Victorian breeding of bloodhounds constituted a masculine, very English and elite affair. And for bloodhound enthusiasts, the supreme excitement of sleuthing was to hunt the scent of man, primarily a consenting elite gentleman, and not animals. And this made the sport profoundly different to other field sports, which usually involved tracking and killing animal prey. Breeders believed that the bloodhound should never be allowed to hunt anything except what came to be known as the clean boot. That is, the scent of the human being without any artificial assistance such as aniseed or animal blood. The phrase clean boot was designed to convey the belief that the strong leather of a gentleman's boot served as a positive interference to a hound endeavouring to detect a human by the scent of his foot. So, conceived as inherently civilised, human scent was considered to be less tangibly odorous than animal scent, and that a specially bred animal was required to detect it. So a bloodhound, by virtue of the animal's very stature, is designed to be low, is bred to be low to the ground, and the nose takes the hound even lower. Not only were bloodhounds bred to possess more nose tissue, literally more nose, because they have humongous noses, but many of their features of their body have been deliberately, and still are, deliberately encouraged to enable them to smell extra strongly. Their ears were said to be long, but not to enable better hearing, as they fall too close to the head. Instead, a slight swing of the head set these ears in motion, fanning up more scent air from the nose to catch. While the constant stream of drool, and anyone who's been close to bloodhound knows this, was considered to be a perfect design to gather extra liquids to the nose tissue for olfactory examination. My purpose in going through this background material is to show how the bloodhound came to be considered as a distinct forensic creature with heightened olfactory powers at the end of the towards the end of the 19th century. The rituals of training bloodhounds enabled bloodhounds to imagine themselves as akin to private detectives, and they developed a novel performative mode of sleuthing, which they frequently claimed had potential for solving real-life murder mysteries. Okay. Oh, that's a picture of Gruff. So we need to go back to the streets of Whitechapel and Edwin Bruff. Okay, purebred bloodhounds were introduced into the press coverage in several formative ways, not least through Bruff's own testimonials to the hunting abilities of his hounds, which became incorporated into the sensational and melodramatic media coverage of the murders. Bruff claimed to understand the ephemeral materiality of human scent, its fleeting nature. And he claimed that as a result of working so closely with hounds in the field, he claimed he was able to predict the presence of human scent trails, even if they were in adverse and exceptional ecological and environmental conditions. He claimed that the nocturnal landscape of Whitechapel provided the optimal conditions for tracking scent, as the empty city resembled the conditions usually found in the wide open wilderness of the countryside. So in the quiet nocturnal hours, scents could be tracked over great distances. And so Bruff hoped to capitalise on the Ripper's choice of small dark silent squares through which very people passed at night to commit his crimes. So the series of Ripper killings then provide a space in which to showcase the abilities of bloodhounds, but also as a means to grasp how scent could facilitate criminal detection. The circulation of Brough's views as to the abilities of Blunt House precipitated an outpouring of scepticism, especially from seasoned huntsmen. For them, the recently revived bloodhound had no real genetic connection to the countryside, and that the bloodhound could barely be considered to be a working animal like a pointer, retriever or foxhound, the staple canine predators of any modern sporting gentleman's kennels. And with its high urban density and variety of life, London was understood, according to hunters, to be a continuous, discontinuous and dynamic olfactory space, crisscrossed by overlapping scent tracks, traces and trails. This was no hunting ground, claimed one sportsman. They believed that the large quantity of competing scents limited how rapidly and effectively a dog could focus on or track an individual scent. And as such, the contamination at the scenes of the crime, such was the contamination of the scenes of the crime that seasoned hunters argued that the footsteps of policemen and doctors would have come and gone. So they questioned how the bloodhound would the bloodhound would be able to tell which scent was that of the Ripper. So such concerns about the strength of the olfactory signature of the Ripper found most cogent expression in discussions over whether the filth of Whitechapel would impede bloodhound pursuits by overwhelming their olfactory sense. Critics pointed to the daily deposits of tons of animal and human excrement, together with the outputs of open sewers, cesspools, pigsties, and the remnants of carcasses of over 13,000 animals slaughtered every week in the knacker's yard, infusing the air with a pungent stench. It was said all this stench resulted in more scent for the dog to eliminate while attempting to discover and follow the scent of a particular person. Not only did such critiques reinforce existing social understandings of the East End as some kind of giant open sewer, channeling deeply moralised notions of filth, they also triggered concerns that bloodhound pursuit would hamper the already difficult search for the murderer. If the hounds were misled by false trails created by contaminating slum stench, the police would make innocent East Enders official suspects. Here, the persistent worry was that a suspicion generated by an alert from a bloodhound would be difficult to dissipate, particularly in an environment widely characterised by social, or widely believed to be full of social unrest, vigilantism, mob justice, and retributive violence. Critics further claim that the demonstrations of clean boot trained bloodhounds in the park trials failed to mimic the challenging conditions in which they were intended to be deployed, the filthy streets of Whitechapel. In an environment where the killer was popularly believed to be a degenerate gentleman splashed in the blood of his victims, dog fanciers and huntsmen argued that the dogs trained to hunt human blood were more equipped to identify and track the trail through the unlit and filthy alleyways of Whitechapel. They didn't care much for the clean boot trained bloodhound. Some claim that only dogs who regularly dined out on blood in their training made the best detectives. To many, the splattered blood of the Ripper's victim seemed to seem more likely to open up a scent trail through the crowded streets of Whitechapel than mere human body odour. Although few entered into an open dialogue on the topic of prostitute blood as scent, they implicitly assumed that the blood of the murdered prostitutes must have possessed a particularly intense enduring odour, which the noses of aristocratic hounds could easily detect. Yet this explicit absence of a dialogue on the nature of the victim's blood entailed a clear breaking of taboos, in part because the blood and scent of prostitutes carried additional gendered connotations. Inevitably, it called into play a long-standing set of meanings: decay, sewers, disease, waste, and the underclass. Furthermore, some breeders recommended that if bloodhounds were going to track the Ripper by following the traces of morally dubious blood through through the Whitechapel streetscapes, they would need to embody the monstrous characteristics of the Ripper. There were lots of proposals. Practice trails should, the Ripper, the bloodhound breeders should actually don the garbs, as there was one suggestion, of the Ripper, and use the pig's blood, or if they could get it, even the blood of human beings through the streets, prepare the hounds. By arguing that bloodhounds require blood in their training, commentators aligned the bloodthirst and hunting instincts of hounds with those of the Ripper himself, which dovetailed the rhetorical strategies of other competing critiques of bloodhound detection. Knowing these, that's a bit scary. That's a better thing, actually, for me. So, in these, critics drew upon the gothic tropes of vampirism and blood drinking, hunting and killing, animal savagery and scent, to depict the bloodhound as a monstrous wild animal that, like the Ripper and the vampire, hunted down its prey by tracking the very smell of its blood. So in the respectable West End Daily, Sir Charles Warren stood accused of organising, promoting a monstrous aristocratic-style hunt in a modern metropolitan city, providing for gentlemen thirsty for new excitement, a new aristocratic sport in the East End. In this sort of configuration, and the point of these sorts of rhetorical attacks on bloodhound detection is to show that the poor citizens of Whitechapel would be hunted down like beasts in the forest. So not only were bloodhounds hunting and aristocrats symbolically and negatively linked, but also the bloodhound plan became an unexpected channel for growing public anxieties about the excesses of the British state, especially the brutality and militarisation of Scotland, or the feared militarisation of Scotland Yard at the time. For many, there was something profoundly disturbing about Scotland Yard having a trained predator at their command with which to hunt other people. Opponents of bloodhound detection argued that Scotland Yard's use of dogs to hunt the Ripper risked reviving a set of dangerous and outmoded canine practices. By drawing attention to the long-standing links between odour and race, dogs and colonialism, especially how the plantation society of the old American South had ruthlessly exploited canine olfactory detection, using hounds to intimidate slaves, or worse, hunt down and brutalise escapees. By drawing parallels between the treatments of blacks in the old South and Whitechapel residents, opponents suggested that Britain was barely different from the slaveholding US, thereby condemning Scotland Yard for treating white citizens much as plantation owners had treated their slaves. The privileged citizenship of the Empire's capital city then did not afford protection against oppression and tyranny. So let's conclude. My aim in this talk has been to use the failure of the bloodhound to track down the Ripper as a window through which we can analyse an emergent forensic specialism, canine forensics, and the challenges it confronts in its attempts to turn dogs into a tool through which to perceive invisible traces. An analysis of public and expert discussions of the uses of bloodhounds helps to illuminate the profile of a way of knowing that is often considered to be marginal or inimical to the development of our modern forensic culture. However, the very marginality of bloodhound forensics is actually a complex social and cultural product involving a wide range of competing agents, players and factors, the analysis of which can shed light on the explicit or often tacit rules shaping the formation of our forensic world, past and present. And so the marginality and controversy surrounding the use of bloodhounds as forensic tools was and is always relational to the establishment and continually shifting social, cultural and legal normative frameworks. So on that note, I'll finish.